Hey everyone, and welcome to Bloodstained, an offshoot of the Vintage Horror Podcast, where we talk about giallo movies. I'm the host, Kyle, and my co-host here is Brady.
Hello.
Today, we are going to be discussing the New York Ripper from 1982, which I'm more than excited about. And quick plot for you. In New York City, a detective calls on the help of a doctor of psychoanalysis in a race to find a murderer who is going around killing young women. It's pretty much that simple.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty pretty to the point here. Not like that last piece of crap we watched. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I still couldn't even tell you what that movie was about if you want me to honestly explain it. But
I was trying to explain it. Sean listened to the episode and he's like, man, you guys really hated that movie, right? And I was like, yeah, if you watched it, you'd feel the same. Like, it's just, couldn't tell you.
I thought you said he had watched it.
He hadn't watched it.
Oh, I thought he'd had. Okay.
No. He was like, man, should I watch this movie? It sounds like you guys hated it. I was like, yeah, I think you can just stay away from it.
Yeah, just listen to what we say, how there's nothing to talk about, and imagine watching that for an hour and a half.
I mean, I guess like if you're somebody who finds himself with nothing to do for an hour and a half and you just really want to waste that time, you could watch it. But
or if you want to see, like, I don't know, nice nipples on a really attractive girl, you could go.
Yeah, she was pretty attractive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something about women of like the 70s, 60s, 70s, like that era. Like, I don't know. They had a different kind of beauty. I don't know how to describe it, but like, there wasn't like all this contouring makeup and changing the way their face looked. It was just, you know, a little bit of eyeshadow and straight hair. And I was like, you know what? I'm in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a good aesthetic. I mean, that was like when you're talking about like the 60s and 70s, like the sexual revolution and like the first wave of feminism. So, I mean, it's definitely more about freedom and expression. And yeah, it is kind of interesting to see how it's evolved from that into like the aesthetic of today, which hairy, I mean, armpits. Isn't bad, but I mean, I have hairy armpits.
Well, I like to cut. Well, I love, okay, so I love when like people are like, well, if you have hairy armpits, then we can have hairy armpits. I'm like, I get rid of my hair and my armpits as much as possible. So
yeah, well, you don't even have like hair on your head, so I just assume that you're just like...
I buzz my head, okay, asshole.
Okay. You buzz your asshole? Out.
Yeah, well, no, but I shave my asshole.
Have you ever nared your asshole?
I've never nared any part of my body because I get too scared.
I haven't either because I heard it burns, but...
Yeah, like, and especially sensitive areas, like, if your skin doesn't react well with it, like, you will be hurting for a squirting.
Like, I would, yeah, definitely be worried about, like, getting nair inside of my body one way or another because I'm pretty sure that that's not good.
Scared I'd get nair inside my body. Well, stop eating it, Brady.
All my organs are just, like, falling out of my ass. I just remember all those videos of like what was it, Nair Cap, when people would just throw Nair on someone in the shower.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man,
I wonder if there's any giallos where people kill people with Nair.
I guess we're gonna make one now.
They make them shit out their own organs that are just melting. God.
It wouldn't surprise me. I'd find it and be like, yeah. Oh man, but yeah, I mean, there's no Nair in this movie, but there's definitely some pretty grotesque kills. The nether regions, that's for sure. What'd you think of it? Did you like it? You'd seen this before, right?
Yes, I had seen this movie before. I had seen it, I think, twice before this. And then I watched it, of course, once to write the review, and then I watched it again this morning.
Mm.
I don't want to exactly tell you how exactly I feel about it.
And we can do that at the end.
Yeah, of course. Of course
we can. Well, then... How long did it take you to figure out who the killer was, if you did?
I'm not going to lie. Okay. So this is, in this movie, I honestly had no idea. And even if I tried to guess a little bit, like in my head as I'm watching, I couldn't, like, I didn't have any solid proof on anyone. Or I thought the red herrings were just red herrings. And I knew that. But like towards the end, when it finally gets revealed, like up until the very second you know who it is, I had no fucking idea.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think the movie did a really good job of casting suspicion on a lot of people, or just, like you said, not having the facts there that you could make a decision. Because it was like every time they introduced a new character who was kind of sinister or seedy, I was like, okay, it's got to be this person. And then somebody else would pop up and I'd be like, well, maybe it's this person. And what was his name? Mikis? Was that his name? The Greek guy? You know who I'm talking about?
The guy with the three, Mickey yeah. Scalenda.
Yeah, Mickey Scalenda. I think it's Mikus is what he calls himself when he's talking on the phone.
Oh, okay.
Like I was convinced like he was from the minute I saw him in that theater. And I guess like I was kind of right in a regard that he was in on it, but not really. And then I thought for a minute that that woman in the theater who was married to the doctor was the Ripper. And then that turned out to be wrong. So, I mean, I suspected who the killer was accurately. Probably it wasn't right as they revealed it, but there's that scene where it's like the three of them sitting at the table where the one professor comes to check in.
Yeah.
That scene, I was like, there's something off here about like the way they're looking at each other.
Yeah. So, and the thing is when, so that's Dr. Paul Davis, when he starts throwing out those kind of things about like his, I guess analysis or guess it, I don't know what you'd consider, I guess the profile of this killer. Like, I think that also puts like some, suspicion on him too. Cause he says like, oh, he's intelligent and well-read and well-spoken, like all this stuff. And like,
he's super handsome. He likes to play chess.
He's literally a doctor. So like, he's smart, you know? But yeah, so you didn't know either to like, well, I mean, if you guessed at that part, then you'd be right. But
yeah, I mean, I still like didn't say like, oh, it's him, but a lot of red flags were going off and I was like, I'm pretty sure like if I had to make a judgment right now, it was going to be one of the two of them, either Paul Davis or
Peter.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what threw me off, because I thought I kind of thought the same thing about Peter, but Faye, when at the end, like that sequence when she has a knife, I was like, wait, is she the killer?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, it was a great movie.
She's smart too, right? I think she does something where she uses her mind a lot. Like, where they specifically say at one point that she has a really high IQ. I don't think they tell you what she does for a living, but
she's a student athlete?
I don't remember. I just remember they said she had a high IQ and like that fucked me up. I was like, wait, is that her? And I just didn't even realize. So
that would have been a really good twist. Yeah, like when she's rewalking like the path where she got attacked, I was like, what if this all turns into a hallucination?
Yeah, because that's like what it kind of turns into when she goes into the theater. So I was like, I think she's just crazy. Because I've seen other movies that are kind of like that. And I hope one day we can talk about them. I don't know if it's quite giallo, but we'll talk about it one day.
You can do like a giallo adjacent movies.
Oh, that if we could do giallo adjacent, I definitely have one in the next coming months then.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it, like if I would assume that on the show we could talk about Malignant if we wanted to, and that's not really a true giallo.
I would. We could go into depth on that. I mean, we kind of talked about it when it first came out, but we could go deeper. That's not a problem.
Yeah. Can always go deeper.
So this movie was originally, I don't know how much you looked into it, but it was originally supposed to be a murderer, about a murderer who has progeria or something, which I guess makes you age faster than you should, so you look older than you do. He was, and the whole idea was like his identity would be hard to pinpoint because he's rapidly aging, which I don't think you age that rapidly, where like literally like they put a picture of you and suddenly nobody knows who the fuck you are,
right?
10 years older. But the constant different appearance would, you know, make it a lot harder to identify them. But it was altered into like the movie that we see today after some rewrites, and then the original idea was, I guess, toned down and made into Phantom of Death in 1988, which I've never even heard of, but
sounds cool.
Yeah, I kind of want to check that out now after I look that up.
Yeah.
And I know much of this movie's like sexual content was, which there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
I would say so far the most sexually charged movie we've watched on here.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I mean, by far.
Honestly, I don't think it's even a competition.
Yeah, in most movies that I've even seen, I would say that this is probably one of the most sexual, but the sexual content was attributed, I guess, to Lucio Fulci by one of his main collaborators, Dardano Sacchetti, who said that, like, and I quote, Fulci, and I quote, nurtured a profound sadism towards women.
Can you imagine that? Like, giving an interview, and they're like, so why were there so many, like, tits in this and like horrible kills. And he's like, yeah, the director just really nurtures a profound sadism towards women. What do you want me to say? Next question. You want to talk about the music?
Well, I mean, so Lucio Fulci, he's the director. Mm-hmm. This is the first movie that I think we've done with him, I believe. Yeah. He's also done other giallo, like A Lizard and Woman's Skin, Don't Torture Duckling. I would say Zombie falls under that category, or at least is close to it. That's one of his bigger hits.
I did see The House by the Cemetery, and that's his, I think.
Yes, The House by the Cemetery, City of the Living Dead, The Black Cat, Manhattan Baby, Murder Rock, Dancing Death, The Devil's Honey, Zombie 3, Demonia. Like, I mean, he's got a big catalog. So a little bit of background on Lucio Fulci. He was a med student who abandoned that career and jumped kind of headfirst into the film industry. So he's a pretty bright guy. He started as a screenwriter and an assistant director, but became prolific and known for directing musicals, comedies, and westerns. He ventured into the thriller genre, but was blacklisted for his commentary and blatant criticisms and negative portrayal of the Catholic Church and Catholicism in general, I guess. Because that's a big no-no, especially out in Italy, where, you know, you kind of have Vatican right around there, you know?
Yeah.
He gained international notoriety after directing Zombie, which in Italy is known as Zombie 2, and it's supposed to be like a sequel to George Romero's Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, but they also said that it was marketed as a sequel without the permission of Fulci or Romero, so.
Yeah. And, I mean, not for nothing, but Italy has a big problem with taking ideas and blatantly stealing them and just making their own like movie of it. And
yeah,
especially, well, back in those days, I don't know if it has something to do with their copyright laws back then, but they didn't give a fuck. And they made a lot of money doing low budget ripoffs of a lot of these movies.
I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong because I haven't looked into it enough, but I just see it on Netflix. It seems like there's a lot of like Indian movies out there that are almost similar to this, like where it's just blatant ripoffs. Like there's a Freddy Krueger one.
Yeah, that's like Mahakal or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I guess,
but that's also like a musical, which I've never seen, but I want to watch so bad. I tried finding it.
I would love to see Freddy Krueger just like singing some show tune while he's murdering a bunch of people. It'd be great.
Mm-hmm. So Lucio Fulci also directed many horror, giallo, thrillers, and even rivaled Dario Argento in popularity. He mm-hmm. died after a long battle with diabetes on March 13th, 1996, at the age of 68. But it did leave behind, of course, a lot of movies.
Yeah.
I don't know if we want to get into characters first, or if you want to just do like a quick run through of the movie.
Let's do characters first.
Okay, so let's do that then. Then we have, I don't know who you want to start with, Fred Williams?
Yeah, let's do Lieutenant Fred Williams, the jaded, burnt out cop played by Jack Headley.
He was definitely in a slew of movies. Most of them, I don't really know, because I think it's a lot of like Western type shit and
yeah, he did a lot of
type things.
He did that, and I mean that's the era too where you had a bunch of like war movies coming out. So he was in The Longest Day with John Wayne. He was in Lawrence of Arabia, which is a pretty notable film, and I mean lauded by critics around. He played in a James Bond film. Did you know that?
Yeah, For Your Eyes Only, which is probably his biggest credit, honestly, as Havelock.
Yeah, and Havelock's parrot.
Wait, he also did the parrot?
Yeah, he voiced the parrot.
Oh, didn't even know that.
Yeah.
I'm not a James Bond guy, so I don't know much about those movies at all.
I love James Bond. If you ever do a James Bond podcast, you know, I'm your guy.
You know what? That sounds like an idea, honestly.
But I also, a thing with this movie is like there was so much dubbing in it too. Mm-hmm. And it threw me off for a lot of parts because, again, there was like another 5 minute stretch where the audio was so far behind how their mouths were moving, and I was like, oh, okay. And it shouldn't take me out of it because I should just be used to it, but it always does. But they said his voice was dubbed by Edward Mannix, an American actor, and Headley's British, so I don't think it would have been that crazy. I mean, do you think it was just that they back then or this guy in general just didn't want to do an American accent. Because you think of people, actors today, and there's a shit ton of British actors that I wouldn't even know until you hear an interview with them.
Florence Pugh I didn't know was
English
until, I don't know, until I actually, like, I guess, looked into her.
Gerard Butler, didn't know he was, like, Scottish. James McAvoy, I mean, his accent's usually there in his movies, but then when you hear him in an interview, it's, like, super thick.
Yeah, I think Tom Holland does a real good job, who plays Spider-Man, especially for someone so young. I was just talking, so Nicole Kidman, at the movies, she has, like, an ad for AMC now that plays before movies. Every time, like, in the last couple times I've been to the movies, I've seen it, and I'm like, I did not know she was Australian. How the fuck did I not know that for all this time?
Didn't you watch her movie Australia with Hugh Jackman?
Nope.
Oh, that would have
told me. And if I did, I probably would have thought that she was putting on an Australian accent for that, honestly. So, like, because I was, like, saying, I can't remember if she ever had an accent in any movie. I feel like she didn't. At least to us. Jack Headley. Mm-hmm. So I think that the thing is with these kind of movies, they let people speak however they wanted to. Because, like, even while they're filming, some people would just be speaking their own native language, whether it was Italian, French, something like German. Some people would be speaking English, and they would just, I guess, know signal words when they should start talking, and they would just dub it all in whatever language they're going to put it out in later. So whether he had an accent or not, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. I don't think they were going to change it or make him necessarily dub himself, because they usually don't for the different languages.
He also just recently died last month.
Yeah, December 11th.
Had no idea. 92 years old.
Insane that you picked it right when he died. You know what? You should never pick another movie again in your life, Brady. I got to tell you.
Oh, I'm going to pick David Gordon Green's Halloween Kills.
Can you pick that every day for the next month?
Right, please.
We also have Mickey Scalenda, who we already mentioned. Mm-hmm. He was played by Howard Ross, who was in Naked Girl Murdered in the Park 10 years earlier as Gunther.
Oh, good old Gunther.
Yeah, and
he was mutant, that right?
That's the guy? Yes, the, like, stable hand guy,
who whatever was fucking the fuck, the redhead girl.
Yeah, but also not the only one fucking her, so
right.
But I mean, he was also in The Pajama Case Girl, which is another giallo. Besides that, I didn't see anything that really stood out.
There's one I'm interested in, Werewolf Woman. He was in that in 1976.
Whenever I see a lot of these old movies, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to take note of this because I want to check this out. But I know deep down inside, I'll just download it and never watch it. So
yeah. And then I'm like, when I see those, I'm like, this looks good, but I could just go watch a Hammer film that I know is going to be better.
And I think that's how a lot of these people are. They're not really in, like, a ton of things. Mm-hmm. We have the guy who played Peter Bunch. I don't want to say he's our main protagonist, because I would say that would honestly go to Mickey. I feel like he was the main protagonist.
Yeah, definitely.
Because Peter just winds up being the killer. So, right. Played by Andrea. Ooh, this is going to be a hard one.
You got it.
Uchipinti.
Hmm.
I'm assuming that's Italian.
You got to say it like Uchipinti. That was racist. I'm sorry.
He was in A Blade in the Dark, which is another giallo.
Yeah.
Dr. Paul. Dave, no, not at all. He produced more after some of his movies than he acted in, and he's still producing things to this day. Yeah. It's a bunch of shit that I still don't know. I think it's mostly Italian stuff, but I think he's made more money or bigger career of producing.
Yeah.
There's Dr. Paul Davis, who was played by Paolo Malco. That's a fucking name.
Paolo Malco from Lizzie McGuire.
Is that somebody's name? Or is that him?
What? Paolo was in Lizzie McGuire.
I never watched it.
Oh, yeah, me either. I just had a sister.
My coworker just, like, loves Lizzie McGuire.
I mean, I wouldn't say I loved it. I just...
You know. Well, I meant, like, Hilary Duff, I should say.
Oh, I mean, she's pretty good.
Well, she's Mary just, like, in love player. With her. She's like, yeah, she was my first girl crush, and that's how I knew I was a lesbian. I'm like, yeah, that makes sense, actually.
I don't know who my first girl crush is. I know my first, like, guy crush was, what's his name from Stranger Things, Billy?
For sure.
When Billy showed up in season 2, I was like, huh,
Am I supposed to be rock hard right now? Right. I really am.
I was like, Paige, can you go in the bedroom for a minute? Can I watch this on my own? I don't think you're going to like this show.
But Paolo Malco, he was in Watch Me When I Kill, House by the Cemetery, Scorpion with Two Tails, Escape from the Bronx, which I assume is just a ripoff of Escape from New York.
Sounds like it.
And You'll Die at Midnight, which is also known as Midnight Killer. So he's got another like little list of things that he was in too. But besides that, like, there wasn't anybody too notable that I saw. I mean, there was, I would say, for the main characters, there was other people who were definitely in other Italian movies that were kind of this, but that definitely fall in line with this kind of genre, but nobody that was in the main cast. I don't know if there's anybody else you thought or we should note.
Who was the girl who played Jane?
Is that the blonde girl?
I believe so.
I don't remember her name, but I know she was in like Zombie Apocalypse or Zombie Holocaust. I mean.
Yeah. Amanda Killer. I got this right here. Hold on. Yeah, everybody else. I mean, not that they were bad or anything, but they just, I don't know. Pretty like regular staples, it seems like. They all somehow know Dario Argento or Fulci, or they got another director they worked with. So, I mean, it seems like they all pretty much run in the same circles in this era.
Yeah, because a lot of these people are definitely in movies together. Mm. There was somebody else that was supposed to be in this movie, and I think that they shared another movie with Paolo Malco. I don't remember who. Somebody who was supposed to play, like, I think Faye's part, I think. But I didn't look too deep into it. It was like another actress,
Catriona McCall.
That might
City
be
of the Living Dead, The Beyond, and House by the Cemetery. Yeah. And then she turned it down. She was a British actress. Yeah.
Yeah. She was a little unsure about whether she wanted to, you know.
Yeah. She read the script and was like,
She's like, wait, people, huh? What? People are getting raped?
Yeah.
Murdered?
They do. What with the glass bottle? Yeah.
But yeah, we can, I guess, go through the movie real quick if you'd like.
Sure.
Stopping to talk about anything of significance if you want.
Before we get into the movie, I just want to give everybody this quote from a film critic, Carol Polsky, who described the film as simply the most damaging film I have ever seen in my whole life. A relentless catalog of the anti-hero villain cutting women up. So just get ready.
And then a Serbian film said, you know what? Challenge accepted.
Oh my God, that film. Anytime somebody says, is there one horror movie you just like would never recommend to somebody? And I go, a Serbian film.
Which kind of sounds like I'm recommending it, but please don't watch it.
Yeah, don't. It's horrible. Watch The Human Centipede instead.
I've never watched it, but I've been curious.
I mean, I'm sure you'll watch it at some point, but I couldn't make it through it. Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Salo's pretty bad, too. But
I haven't heard of that, but I probably will not watch it.
I think it's right along the same lines, honestly. So, yeah, I mean, we can... So... The movie obviously begins with a man walking his dog. Dog finds a severed hand. That kind of starts things out. That is an actress, correct? That they wind up saying it's an actress or
she was a model.
A model, yeah. And that's who the landlady is. Like that's that girl's landlady, correct?
Mrs. Weisberger.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She was a landlady because she was like, yeah, I heard somebody call and they were using a strange voice.
Obviously the detective in charge of investigating women murdered, talks to the landlady, Mrs. What was her name?
Weisberger.
Weisberger, who says that someone's talking to a woman on the phone. Sounds like a duck. That's a big point. There's the woman who's riding, dude, I love this fucking girl who's like riding her bike and she bumps into like a red car and the guy like leads his head out the window. He's like, you women should stay home where you belong. You're a menace to the public. You got brains of a chicken. And I'm like, you know what? He's got a point there.
Oh my God.
My kind of guy talking down to all the women.
Oh Lord.
It's crazy to think that like, I mean, I guess some people probably still feel that way, but like even in like the 80s, that was like a thing that people would just outwardly say to women. Like you guys belong in the house. Like they should never let you out in public.
What's crazy is like, we think that it's like, oh, like that happened just so long ago. I mean, this movie came out like, what, in the 80s? So
yeah, so it's about to be 40 years old.
Yeah, and I mean, that still happens today. Like, yeah. You go to New York City or you go to Boston and you hear some pretty nasty things.
Yeah. I like how New York this movie is too, though. Like, yeah. Shit like that. Like, I mean, most places people probably wouldn't just outright say that, but a New Yorker's like, hey, fuck you, asshole. Like, go back to the house.
Yeah.
Mine or his?
Yours.
Oh, thanks, man. I've been practicing. The car pulls into the ferry to get into Manhattan, and the girl rides her bike onto the ferry. She goes into the red car that she bumped into earlier, starts writing on it with lipstick, and then you get like a person who looks down at her legs, which I guess she's wearing short shorts and
Well, she's on a bike, like, you know.
Yeah. She closes her legs, and he pulls out a knife, kills her by stabbing her in the stomach, and then pulling the knife like upward, then stabbing her in the chest, and pulling the knife down, then cuts her throat. Pretty brutal, violent. I want to say in terms of giallos, I mean, we've seen some like crazy stuff, but I feel like this one's like extra mean spirited in the way that the women are murdered.
Oh yeah, I mean, this kill alone was really visceral too, because it's like when he first stabs her, like that blood just like squirts out.
Uh-huh.
And then the whole time, like her screaming, and it was just like, ugh, like very uncomfortable.
Yeah, they're kind of dragged out. It's definitely uncomfortable. They're definitely mean-spirited, and they're very graphic. You see a lot of the cuts that get made in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The car then gets pushed into the light, and the body gets discovered. The coroner determined that both women were killed by the same person, both left-handed. So I guess the person who did it was left-handed? Is that what they're saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's another thing. I always forget about that part, honestly. And I don't even know if they ever use that as a callback, but
they just go to like the missing fingers.
The man who sounded like a duck called the station for lieutenant. He said he'd call back. I like how he's like
fucking weird voice, man. Yeah. Like when he's quacking, I get it. But like when I first read the synopsis before we watched it, it was like, oh, this murderer stalks and kills women and talks like Daffy Duck or Donald Duck. And I was like, oh, okay, that's going to sound good. And like, it did not sound anything like Donald Duck to me.
But you expected like, yeah, it's wabbit season.
Oh, that's Daffy, you idiot.
Oh, Daffy, whatever. Oh, Donald, you're right.
And that part, right. You get when he's like quacking, but like when Donald talks, like he still is like, kind of sounds like he's quacking at the same time. And this guy was just like, hello, detective.
I think that's a very common like giallo voice too.
Hmm.
Detective goes to see Dr. Paul Davis, the doctor who knows, or the doctor knows about it, like the murders. And he, the detective, wants him to help.
Playing chess by himself. Yeah.
Yeah. You see a man that goes to see a live sex performance on stage. And then Jane, a woman in the audience, starts recording the audio and like masturbating while watching.
Yeah.
Which, hey, you know what? More power to you. If it was a man, we'd get arrested.
It took me a second to realize. I don't know if I was just distracted at this part, but I didn't realize it was a live sex scene until they walked off the stage at the end, and I was like, what the fuck is happening?
So
I thought she was just like in a theater, like in a like a porn theater.
Oh, like just watching a movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll talk a little bit more about all this at the end if you're interested of
sure,
that kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying? I'll give you the links. No,
okay.
I'm just kidding. Backstage, performer gets stabbed in the stomach with a broken bottle, killing her like in a dark room. Of course, the person's quacking. The quacker calls a hotel room / apartment for the lieutenant, taunting him, saying he killed again and calling the detective stupid. Detective Williams, right, that's his name, like doesn't know how the killer knows that he's with a prostitute, because I'm assuming that's not his hotel room. I'm assuming that's like hers
her apartment.
Or yeah, where yeah. She just brings guys back. John's back, I should say.
Yeah. You also forgot. Oh, go ahead.
I just love when he's like, oh, can you get me some coffee? And she's like, I'm a prostitute. I'm not your wife.
Yeah. I was like, yeah, you go.
Yeah.
Well, at the same time that I was watching this, before you find out that she's a prostitute, I messaged you and I was like, there's no way this guy's pulling this girl. And then like as soon as I sent it, she was like, I'm a prostitute. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, trust me, I thought the same thing first time I watched this. I was like, wait, what is happening here? There's no way this guy's fucking her.
Yeah. I mean, he was, but he was paying for it.
Well, yeah.
In the theater where the sexy sex is happening, there's also a man sitting there watching Jane as she's masturbating. Mickey Scalenda.
Yeah, it's Mickey
Scalenda. Scruffy, dangerous-looking man with two fingers missing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if they... I think they did show that at that part, too, right? That he was missing fingers. Yeah, that's a big plot point, I guess. Even though I guess it really doesn't pay off to anything at all, but...
Really? Well, yeah.
Jane walks in... on her husband, like listening to the audio of the sex performance because she records all these things, I guess, and she has to take the car. He gives her a recorder and tells her to make plans for the evening because he has plans for himself. So I think this might, no. Maybe Mickey Scalenda was the first like real red herring in the theater.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like when he's sitting there, he's like, okay, like this guy, like why is he just staring at this woman masturbating?
Yeah, and then it kind of sounds like Jane's husband's supposed to be like the second red herring, but I never suspected this guy because he's like old and dumb as fuck and just horny. Yeah. And but when he says like make plans because I have plans, I think that's supposed to be like, oh, what the fuck are his plans? Dr. Davis listens to the tapes of the killer. He starts to form like a profile. Then Jane at a bar makes makes eyes at Latino men playing pool. One takes off his loafer and starts towing Jane, and by towing I mean like he's fingering but with your toe.
Dude, this was like I was like almost like I'm gonna have to just Google the rest of this movie because I cannot watch this if this keeps happening.
Like, and it's so long.
Oh, like not the toes are long, but just like the scene. It was disgusting. Like I can see people get butchered on TV. I can handle like some pretty bad scenes, but this one's up there, man. Like I hate feet. Feet are the most disgusting things about humans, and I just, oh, how it like lingers on it too. I was like, you gotta be like, how much do you have to be like getting paid to be like, yeah, I'll let this guy just like toe me on screen. Like that's
cool. I don't know if his toe was actually in her vagina.
It was still on it. That's close enough.
So what grosses me out, like, it's not even, because I'm not, like, one of those people that's like, ah, oh, feet are disgusting, can't stand feet, like, but this is also, like, the 80s. Either way, I don't care if you're in New York or not, like, it's supposed to take place in New York, and either way, it's still the 80s, and that's 80s feet. I don't think their hygiene was as good as it is now, so no matter what, like, that's the disgusting part to me.
And they're in, like, a fucking dive bar playing pool, like, you can't tell me, like, they're, like, it's not, like, some swanky club where you just like took a nice shower and got like maybe put some lotion on your feet.
Yeah.
Nope. He was then when he was in there, just a dry guy with those crusty ass feet.
Well, she might not have been dry. So, then when Jane's about to come, they pull the table away so it's visible for everyone, and she runs to the car or drives off, all embarrassed. That guy who's like using his toe on her, he I think had a pretty or still has a pretty extensive career. I think he still does a lot of acting. He might even be
producing. He goes to like a casting call. He's like, they're like, all right, what's your previous work? He's like, you ever seen New York Ripper?
They're like, okay, next.
I'm pretty good on my feet.
Wing, wing. Then we see a girl named Faye on the subway. She notices a man on the car. The man is Mickey Scalenda, missing two fingers, and he like walks her down. She runs out of the car at the next stop, runs down the streets trying to get away, but he's following her. And then she runs to the Quacking Killer, who slices her leg and misses the second swipe, hitting a wall with a knife. Plot point. She dreams she's in a theater being attacked with a straight razor, sliced several times. Yeah. That's where things kind of get a little bit like odd.
Yeah.
Because I almost thought that they were going to switch to like a supernatural kind of thing at that part. I was like, this is getting a little weird.
Yeah.
She's in the hospital, and the man from her dream comes in, but it turns out to be Peter, her boyfriend, husband.
I think he's just a boyfriend.
And she tells him about her dream. And then Detective Williams and Dr. Davis start like looking for the guy missing two fingers.
Faye is talking to Peter about the dream, and then this is the sequence where she's like, I need you to tell me it's fine that like I said some things about whatever the little girl's name was, Susie, and you don't really know who Susie is at this point, and Peter's like trying to laugh it off, and he's like, ah, it's okay, like, don't, you have nothing to worry about. And she's like, no, I need you to tell me it's okay. So like that, in that moment too, I was like, all right, there's somebody here that they're not showing us for some reason.
Yeah,
but as soon as they brought up Mickey again, I was like, oh, it's gotta be this guy.
Yeah, and these two characters are also brought in, I think it's like 33 minutes into the movie. Mm-hmm. And the movie's only like, what, an hour and 29 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
And then Jane goes to the hotel with Mickey. I forget how she meets him exactly.
She just like, picked him up.
Yeah. And then while she's like recording the audio, he ties her to a bed, turns up the music, and makes a phone call. And then later falls asleep next to naked Jane after... is that like slices on her, or is that the shadow?
No, it was definitely slices, but I couldn't figure out if it was from a knife or just like scratch marks. Yeah. I mean, you're led to believe that they're just like into really rough stuff. I mean, obviously she had a foot up her vagina, so like,
yeah, and that was New York for the time.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, but I never understood this really well. So I thought she was into it, and then it looks like she's scared, like while he's sleeping next to her. And I don't know if that's just because she thinks that he might be the killer, that she's in danger, but like I thought that she agreed to like this BDSM, but then it also seems like she didn't, so I was confused here.
So what I thought was that, like, yes, she was into it, but when he tied her up and then turned up the music right away, and instead of just like starting stuff, he makes a phone call, I think she's like, oh, that's a little weird. Red flag.
Red flag. Like, hey, I ordered us a pizza for afterwards.
And then, I mean, she's just mad, you gotta get a tied up, because she's like, I didn't even get the pizza because he fell asleep.
Yeah. I mean, pizza's just waiting at the door. Getting cold.
And then the radio DJ on the radio, obviously, announces like to the man with two fingers on his right hand, or says like he is the Ripper.
He calls him the New York Ripper.
Missing two fingers. Yeah. And she notices that he's missing two fingers. So she's like, wait, hold up.
What? Oh, it looks so fucking gross too.
The fingers,
yeah, when his hand is like just like sliding up her body, and I was like, ew, what the hell is that?
Yeah, I liked it though, you know, it was nice.
It reminded me of watch a scary movie too.
this is my strong hand.
Take my strong hand.
She unties herself and runs through the hall of the hotel trying to find an exit, and then runs into the quacking murderer, who pulls out a knife, stabs her to death in the hallway. Lieutenant Williams shows the audio tapes to Dr. Lodge, I think his name was. That's her husband.
Yeah.
And tells him that they have the identity of the man thanks to the audio recordings, I guess.
Thanks to your extracurricular activities.
Yeah. Some, I forget how, but they pinpointed, or somebody that worked at the theater, I guess, pinpointed, or picked him out of a lineup, or not lineup, mugshot, like lineup kind of thing. But then Dr. Paul Davis tells the secretary that he thinks the Ripper is young, intelligent, affable, and from a good family.
Yeah.
So he's pretty much like, I could be the Ripper, just so you know.
Right. She's like, he's like, when he's talking to him, he's like, I just don't think that this guy is intelligent enough to do all this. And then, yeah, you're like, he's like, you know, he's got to be intelligent, he's got to be smart, and he's got to be handsome. And I was like, all right, dude, calm down here.
Gotta have a big dick, right? Like, bigger than 8 inches.
And was Davis like, did he bought like a gay porn magazine, right?
Oh, I don't even know, I wasn't paying attention. Was it, what did he buy?
He bought like the Blue Boys or whatever it was called.
I don't know.
He's like at the newspaper stand, and the he's like, it was all like male-oriented porn. And then the newsy guy like puts it in the newspaper and gives it to him. And then he walks away. But like, I never saw it again. So I was like, what is the point of this?
Maybe they're supposed to show that he's gay, and maybe he doesn't find women attractive, so he'd be more likely to kill him. I don't know. It's supposed to throw you off?
I guess so. But it didn't really throw me off. It just made me go, huh.
I feel like that's how a lot of things in these, they're like, yeah, we're going to put something in here to really throw people off. And you just watch it, and you're like, yeah, I don't know what just happened, but I'm going to forget that ever happened.
Like, good for him. He found some porn he likes. Like, what does this have to do with the movie? But anyways, I digress.
The cops search the apartment of Mickey Scalenda, And then Faye goes to stay with Peter while, I guess, healing after their hospital visit, stay, whatever you want to call it. Dr. Davis goes to see them and question Faye, asking if she's sure it's Mickey. And she says she isn't positive. And then Peter goes out, says he'll be back.
This was the scene that got me, because when Davis is sitting there like, are you sure? Peter like shoots her a look. Like, it's super awkward. And I was like,
yeah,
why would he do that? And why would they focus on that?
Yeah. And I think some of those things attribute to the Giallo formula. We're supposed to notice it more the second time around, but even still, like, what I noticed, the way he's looking more at Paul.
Yeah.
Cause they do a good job of having Paul's side profile looking at Faye, like, in the foreground. And then they go to the background, like they focus in on the background where you see Peter looking at him like intensely, and he's like, oh, you all right? He's like, oh, I'm gonna go get some coffee, do you want any?
Yeah.
And he's like, no. And then it zooms back out to Paul. But I think for me, that part is like, yeah, again, the dead giveaway, that who's, or who I thought would the killer would be, but then I got fucked up later in the head.
And then Paul tells away... oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and then when Peter goes out, like, Faye goes upstairs to this room, and it's, like, full of dolls and, like, children stuff. And so here, excuse me, I was like, all right, this has to be, like, the reveal where you find out it's Peter, because he has, like, this weird infatuation from his childhood. And then I got, like, mad sleepaway camp vibes, where I was like, is Peter really, like, a chick? Like, reverse? And then Mickey climbs up through the window and rushes in there and tries to kill Faye just as Peter gets home. And then Peter runs up. This scene too, like, made me just like laugh out loud, because Peter runs up the stairs past Mickey. Mickey like kind of checks him with his shoulder, and Peter's already above him, but then falls backwards. I was like, all right, either this was just like really bad acting, or they did this on purpose to make it look like they weren't in cahoots together. And so this is kind of where I started piecing everything together.
Yeah. And then, well, also, like, right after the part where Peter goes out, I think Paul tells Detective Fred Williams that he thinks that Faye's holding out on him, and she doesn't think that it's Mickey.
Yeah.
But then Williams is like, no, it's Mickey. We have our guy. Like, that's who it is. We're going to go find him. And I think that's where you're supposed to see how burnt out he actually is, and how he's like, I don't care. We're just pinning it on somebody to close this case. Like, let's get this over with. But then, yeah, you see the police patrolling, looking for Mickey, and the Ripper calls for Lieutenant Williams, saying that he's going to dedicate a murder to him, all while, like, the phone call is being traced. And then when they trace the call, they go to a harbor. But the harbor, like, it's just like it looks like a walkie-talkie that's, like, next to a payphone.
Yeah, he basically had it, like, the walkie-talkie, like, duct-taped next to an open payphone, and he was talking from the other end from Kitty's apartment.
Yeah, the old walkie-talkie payphone trick.
We've all been there, huh?
Yeah. And Kitty, of course, is the prostitute that Williams was with earlier. They find the Ripper uses, like, razor blades, cutting her multiple times, slicing her nipple, cutting
her into her
eyeball. Oh. Yeah. When I was watching this morning, Sam was kind of watching a little bit, and I said, yeah, I'm going to tell you something. You shouldn't watch this next part, because she can't deal with eye stuff. Yeah. Like, she hates...
Did she watch?
No, she didn't watch it. She went back to sleep. She said, I'm just going to go back to sleep then. But yeah, she cuts into the eyeball. I think that's one of the most infamous scenes from this. I know that that shot specifically, like, this whole sequence, is what led to it, like, not being full, like, the uncut, unedited version has never been released in the UK. They didn't even have this movie in the UK until the 2000s, and even still, it had like 16 or 19 seconds cut out of it because of shit like this. And I would say this is probably the most mean-spirited kill of this whole movie.
It's up there for me.
Okay, we'll talk about that.
We'll talk about it.
Detective Williams arrives too late. Kitty's dead. Then Mickey's body's discovered dead from suffocation, now decomposing. So it couldn't have been him who killed Kitty, because they said he was dead 8 days, but Kitty was killed 4 days ago. And I think the coroner says that he put the bag around his own head and killed himself.
Yeah, they said it was suicide. And at first when they showed Mickey, it didn't look like Mickey to me. I thought it was Paul.
Yeah.
And I thought it was like weird, like this big reveal where like somebody got to Paul.
He was like greenish, and
yeah,
I guess that was supposed to be him decomposing. But like, I also don't understand how somebody kills himself with a plastic bag around their head. I feel like that'd be a really hard way to do that to yourself. But
yeah, you would have to like rig it up so that there was no way for you to like rip it off. Because I mean, you think about like, not to get morbid here, but like if somebody hangs himself, like there's nothing for you to do. Like you kick the chair away, like. Your instinct is to claw at the rope or the belt or whatever. So like if you do it this way, like all you have to do is fucking use your fingers to tear open the bag. So I just don't understand.
That's why when they said that, I was like, I wonder if like somebody, he was killed and like they just think it's a suicide.
They must have been some shitty cops then.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, he killed himself with a plastic bag over his own head. They're like, all right, good enough for me.
Well, I've seen Making a Murderer, so I know that, you know, they say some crazy shit to frame people for things. Then we see Faye go to a hospital to see Susie, who's Peter's very ill daughter. I don't know if they ever say what she's ill with, but I know she's got, like, one arm.
I was going to say she was missing an arm, right?
That's what she's sick with. They're like, yeah, you just got to stay in the hospital forever. She's like, I've been healed for 4 years. Yeah, just sit in this fucking hospital, please. She walks back home, walking past where she was attacked, seeing the damaged wall where the knife hit it when the killer missed, and it triggers a memory. Lieutenant Williams and Paul discuss Faye's high IQ and tendency to hallucinate, and this is where I started thinking, like, fuck, I was wrong. It's Faye, and I'm just a fucking idiot, fuck.
Yeah.
The only part that really threw me off was that there was a notch in the wall, so I'm like, did she do that herself, or
yeah,
like, was this a Fight Club type moment? Faye gets back home. Yeah, exactly. Faye gets back home, interrupting Peter working on a math problem, and then you're kind of like, wait, but he's the one working on a math problem, is he the intelligent one? And she goes to make food, and then Williams and Paul visit Susie and learn that no one has visited her, I guess, and one parent is away in Brazil.
It's poor girl, one arm, nobody visiting her.
Yeah, and then they say, like, one parent is in Brazil, but they don't say mother, or mother, father, or anything like that. And they say, well, I think we're just supposed to call them parents no matter what now.
Yeah.
But the other one pays bills but never visits. So,
My dad did that.
Yeah, it's child support, right? That's what that is.
Yeah. What a point of child support.
Yep, I'm right there with you, buddy. Yeah. if I was lucky, it got paid. Paul figured out the motive and tells detective that to have Peter's house under surveillance. And then Faye notices a knife with a chip in it, in the tip, and Peter answers a call from someone quacking like a duck. He calls out to Faye, and we see that the like knife is missing now. So this is another point where I'm like, fuck, it definitely is
Faye.
Yeah. Peter yells up to Faye while running up the stairs, not to go into Susie's room, and is stabbed twice by Faye before falling back down the stairs. Mm-hmm. She walks down past him, and he pops up, attacking her. Because then I'm like, fuck, it is Faye. She's just fucking, you know, like...
crazy.
Yeah, schizophrenic or something. Like, crazy. She made this all up in her head. But then Peter, like, fucking tackles her and about to stab her as he's talking in a duck voice. But then he's shot through the face by Lieutenant Williams.
Oh, such a good shot, too.
It was probably my least expected thing to happen in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, when I just came
in, come in and shoot him.
Yeah.
But not through the face like that.
Yeah, it's so sudden and visible. And then Faye figured it out, she says, when she heard Peter talking to his daughter on the phone in the duck voice. Paul says Peter created the duck and changed to the duck to kill, separating himself from the guilt. And then you see Susie, like, crying after calling Peter's house and getting no answer. Which is like the fucking most depressing way to end this movie.
Daddy! I was like, oh, been there.
And yeah, that's a New York Ripper.
Yeah. I mean, so I know I've said a lot about how like this movie is like super gory and like sexually charged, and like it may have sounded like I didn't enjoy it. I think it's a fun movie.
Yeah.
I know like when you get into the critical reception of it, like I think on Rotten Tomatoes, it's got an approval rating of 14% based on 7 reviews.
Yeah.
So it's like a weighted average of 3.10 out of 10. There's a couple quotes that I think we should go through. Eric Henderson of Slant Magazine called the film sour and pointless, adding that it utilizes all the necessary ingredients but fails to summon from them the dignity one expects from finer New York City films. And on his website, Fantastic Movie Musings and Ramblings, David Sindelar criticized the film's cliched plot, obvious identity of the killer, and attempts at pathos, the latter of which he felt were forced and ineffectual. I just gotta say, I don't think the identity was obvious.
No, I didn't think so either.
And I didn't feel like it had a cliched plot either. Or maybe, I mean, I just assumed that all giallos have this plot, so I guess it is cliched. But I thought this one actually was pretty interesting. Like, I hadn't heard a duck voice before, and like the quacking. And I thought the kills were very effective and gory and mean-spirited. And I also, like, the thing about the obvious identity of the killer really gets to me, because I don't think it was that obvious.
Did they ever say what the motive was exactly? Is it the fact that, like, his daughter can't ever grow up to be a woman, so he hates women or something like that?
They never talked about the motive. They just, when they start suspecting Peter and following him and then find Susie, Davis had said that, like, his new profile had evolved to be a young man who hates sexually active women, but they never said why. So then he was like, he's got to be following Mickey and just like picking off his victims. But I thought he and Mickey were like in cahoots.
Yeah, that's the way it made it seem, that like Mickey called him.
Yeah.
And I think they even say like, or that's the way they made it seem, like Mickey was just his doing his dirty work, like collecting the women kind of thing. But
yeah,
the only person that Mickey ever was involved with that they killed was Jane. So I don't know.
Maitland McDonough from TV Guide gave the film 1 out of 4 stars, writing, Fulci alternates sleazy sex scenes with graphic and deeply misogynistic murders, fills the plots with twists that make no sense, then wraps the whole thing up in a preposterous psychological flourish.
Well, that's what all giallos are. Most of them don't make sense until the end, and then you go, oh, okay.
Robert Fershing of All Movie claims that the film was Fulci pandering to the lowest common denominator as never before in his career. He added that Fulci showed with this blatant play for the sicko slasher crowd that the days of well-plotted, stylish Italian horror were gone, replaced with the most vicious sort of sexual violence and perversion, concluding that the film was a shameful piece of work. And then
when were these written?
This was written when it came out, looks like.
All of these, right?
Yeah. And then in September of 2006, film director Andrew Rapaski McElhenney hosted a free public last screening at the Cinemagic 3 in Philadelphia before the theater got like torn down. And he chose the New York Ripper to show, which I think would have been fucking fantastic if like this old timey theater, they were like, yeah, we're going to tear it down. The last one we're watching is like some giallo. He introduced it. And then in the program notes for the screening sponsored by University of Pennsylvania, he wrote that Lucio Fulci's The New York Ripper is an immoral ethnography of modern city life, varnished in grime, sex for sale, and violence for pleasure. And he continued his defense of the movie, writing, a dangerous film flitting, sometimes incoherently, between the hyper-real and the surreal. The New York Ripper reminds us that true horror movies should not be safe entertainments, and, profoundly, that the boogeyman is not some sicko who carves up women for fun, but something far worse. Something inside us all. Something that kills unconsciously 1,000 times each day via self-perceived moral authority. A casual callousness to our environment and an indifference to unequivocal social justice for all. The New York Ripper is a horror film par excellence. One that goes, quote-unquote, too far and makes the spectator complacent, if not complicit, in the rot. Featuring haunting location photography of a Big Apple that no longer exists, Fulci's film is perhaps the ultimate examination of urban decay and individual isolationism exacerbated by modern metropolitan living. So he seems to, you know, really be plugged into the Fulci here.
Yeah. So, okay. I know. So I get it. Like back then people like hated horror movies.
Yep.
Still hated them. Yeah. Well, I mean, they get a little bit more critical reception.
They still don't win any fucking Oscars or any Academy Awards, even though some of the performances are the best out there. And I'm not saying that New York Ripper should have won any awards, but...
Oh, it should have. but so here, like, but like you got to think of Friday the 13th, 1980, you know? I don't know. I think a lot of people liked Halloween, so I won't include that. But like people thought that Friday the 13th was like a fucking abomination. And then you compare that to like this that came out 3 years later, people were probably like, Jesus fucking Christ, we thought it couldn't get any lower, right? You know? And but back then they wanted to wipe horror movies like this off the face of the earth. They didn't think that they had a place in society. Now it's kind of like, okay, we get it. Like, we understand that it is just an art form. It's not exactly, you know, it doesn't always appeal to everyone, but it's more accepted. Back then, I think critics just generally hated almost any horror movie, especially like a slasher giallo-esque movie that came out. And we all know this. They looked down on this type of genre. They thought it was fucking for the worst of the worst people, when it was just people who wanted to see fun stuff. I don't... But like to say that this is unrealistic or anything like that, I'm going to go into like a little bit of history here.
Yeah.
In Times Square on December 2nd, 1979, two bodies were found decapitated and their hands cut off in a hotel room. And the hotel room was set on fire. And this led to similar cases all the way through 1980. And eventually the revelation came out that there was other crimes attributed to the same killer that span back to 1967. So from 1967 to 1980, this guy was going around killing people in New York City, well, and New Jersey, but it led to Times Square. The man, Richard Cottingham, was then given the titles The Torso Killer and Times Square Torso Ripper. Mm-hmm. And anywhere I looked, it didn't attribute the murders to like for the inspiration of this movie, but I don't see how they can be separate. Like, literally the first thing that you see in this movie is a fucking hand in a dog's mouth. Like the killer cut off somebody's hands.
Yeah. Yeah, it's gotta be like, did you watch the special on Netflix yet?
Yes. The crime scene, the Times Square killer.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I was going to say. I mean, this is that literally talks about the porn and sex industry in Times Square in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah,
that this was a good representation of what it was actually like in the middle of fucking Times Square.
Yeah,
in New York, but specifically Times Square. It was a sexually charged place. It's not Times Square like we know it now. It's not the fucking, you know, like Disneyland back then like it is now. It's not commercialized. It was raunchy, raw. It was a lot of sex sold there. And they even had, like, that's why in the beginning when they were at the movie, or not the movie, the show where they're watching people have sex live on stage, that's a real thing that happened. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not something Fulci just created in his fucking head for this movie.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think, like, whether they ever alluded to it or not, or didn't want to, like, it's, the inspiration is definitely there.
Yeah. From what I looked at, I didn't see anything that was attributed. But like I said, it has to be. It has to be. Hotel rooms, like fucking being murdered, people being murdered. Like the only thing that kind of throws me off about this movie is it's a lot of like New York, and then every once in a while you go to like Peter's house and it doesn't look anything like anywhere you'd ever seen New York, like his apartment building. Like I know it said most of the scenes outside were filmed in New York Times Square and then the insides were in Rome. I wouldn't doubt that specific place is in Rome.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but I think it also, like, going into what the director said in that last quote, is like it just shows the two different sides of, you know, metropolitan life. So you have the high class, you know, academic lifestyle that Peter and Faye have and Davis has, and then you have like the more blue collar mean streets kind of version that you're finding all these like seedy murders in. So
yeah.
I liked it.
But I mean, yeah, it didn't get very good criticism from critics, like you said, a 14%. But then if you look at the audience score, it's 54%, which isn't the best score, but it's a lot higher than 14%.
Yeah.
It's got a 6.4 out of 10 on IMDb and 3.3 out of 5 on Letterboxd, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it just goes into like you said, people are just having these newfound appreciations for horror as an art form and not looking down on it quite so much. And so people's views of it are changing.
Yeah. And I think they, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I think people are starting to realize that life doesn't always imitate art, and you can make movies about the stuff and people don't necessarily watch it and then go out and reenact it. So it's not as harmful as they thought it was. It's just like any medium. When television first came out, people were like, what? Like, that's dog shit. And you got to listen to the radio because TV's bad for your brain. And
right.
Video games come out and, oh, that's bad for you. Like, but then they realize it actually helps you, you know, cognitively. So it's always that old people pushing back against the new young hip stuff.
Boomers.
Yeah. I don't know. So you were saying that the kitty kill wasn't the most, I guess.
Spirited.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought, that, what's her name? Give me a second. Ooh. The performer from the theater, I thought her kill was more mean-spirited when he like takes the glass, broken glass, and like shoves it into like her vagina and like is just like twisting it.
Yeah, I guess I could see that.
I think Kitty's was like really fucking brutal too. And like, I think Kitty's is my favorite kill of the movie. But I think in terms of like something that made me go, that was just fucking mean, was when he kills the performer because he toys with her. He's like, got the light bulb that's been shattered that's on the ground that she steps on, and it's just dark in there, and then it just like comes out of the curtain. So I like,
yeah, I did like that kill, but I feel like that one was so not fast, but it happened a lot faster than the other kills in the movie.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, for me, just the way everyone else's kind of lingered, I feel like, longer than it should have, except for maybe Jane. She kind of just got knifed up quick too, and then he's like
yeah, then it comes away.
But yeah, I would say my favorite kill is definitely Kitty's. When he cut through the nipple, I was like, holy shit, I cannot believe they're like showing this. And then to the eye, and I was like, and I had seen that eye kill on like lists before of like some of the worst kills or like the most gruesome kills. Like, I had seen that, and I'd never realized that it was from New York Ripper. So when I first watched this, I was like, oh, that's what that's fucking from. Because that's fucking brutal too. Like the, I don't know, all the prosthetics and the makeups, and
it was done well.
Yeah, obviously they didn't really cut into a girl's face, but the way they made the animatronic of the eye. Oh movement,
god, yeah,
yeah,
that was rough to watch.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah. So that's probably my favorite kill of the series, or not series, the movie. But yeah, I'm gonna say, I'm gonna rate it 4 out of 5.
Mm.
I honestly think that this is my favorite giallo that I've seen so far. And not that I've seen a terribly big selection yet, but I did like some other ones a lot, but this, it's so raunchy, and I don't deny it. I'm definitely into like the sexualization of horror. I like sleazy horror. I love it. And this is right up there, some of the worst of the worst. And I don't like it just to try to sound like, oh yeah, I like really dirty shit, but like it's fun to me. Like, I don't take it serious at all, and I think the kills are fucking brutal and graphic, and yeah. So 4 out of 5. I watched it, I think, once or twice before this, and I watched it twice for doing this, and I will definitely revisit it again.
Yeah, I'm going to give it the same rating, a 4 out of 5. First time watching it for me, had heard quite a few things about it from Kyle before. and so I didn't really know what to expect, but at the same time, I kind of did. I was pleasantly surprised with it. I also think that it's the best giallo we've seen so far, although I really do like opera. I thought that was really fun. I just think that this one's probably the most well-made one we've seen so far. And I think that, especially coming off of Naked Girl Murdered in the Park, this movie is very cohesive. And yeah. I don't know. I just wasn't bored at all. Like, I think the kills were incredibly well done and were super gory and gave you that factor of being uncomfortable, because that's exactly what he was going for. And you know, the characters, there wasn't anybody who stuck out to me that I was like, man, I love them, but nobody stuck out to me like, man, I hated them. They all just worked together well for the whole movie. And yeah, I mean, I'll definitely watch it again, and I'll recommend it to people who, you know, are in for a good sleazy 80s giallo film. Like,
yeah,
I don't think it gets much better than this in terms of that.
I agree. Anything else to say on this movie?
No. Okay. No, I think I said it all.
Then the next pick is mine, and I'm going to choose A Blade in the Dark. Okay. I can't remember what year it came out, but I think it was by... what the fuck is his name? Lamberto Bava. So,
ooh, Bava. Yeah, 1983.
So it's also from 1983. Yep. This is, I think, one of the bigger ones where I've seen the poster plenty of times, and I'm pretty sure they have Blu-rays of it out. But yeah.
Oh, I do want to say that I really love the theatrical poster for New York Ripper. I think really, really cool.
Yep. So there's a company that I just got some hats from. I got a Jason Takes Manhattan hat and a Fright Night hat. They, I think it's like horrorhats.com or something like that. But they came out with a New York Ripper one, and I almost bought it. Because it almost looks a lot like the poster, but shout out to them. Shout out to this movie. I love New York Ripper. And I just hope that it doesn't go downhill in energy for us from here on out. It kind of sucks, like the reviews. And when I say 4.5, I also want to just kind of put out there, that's in terms of, I guess, giallos. That's not how I like in my grand scheme of like movies that I've seen.
Yeah.
It's not a 4 out of 5, but for a giallo, I'd say it's pretty up there.
Yeah.
And yeah, so next, A Blade in the Dark, 1983, and we'll see you then.
Oh yeah. Ta-ta.
Ta-ta.